Welcome everybody to this class about language as social action. I hope you all enjoyed the text about Wall of Ritually Stalled poetry that you just read, and we will come back to that in a minute. But first, what do we mean when we say that language is a form of social action? Well, the basic insight that I would like to share with you today is that language is more than just a tool for transmitting information. Language is above all something that we use for acting in and acting upon the world around us. And for those of you who know already a bit more about discourse analysis, it might seem obvious, but it took quite some time for this insight to be generally accepted. Let us therefore start by taking a step back in time to the beginning of the 20th century. Some of you might be familiar with the picture that you now see in front of you. It is a symbolic representation of how speech communication works, the Saussurean speech circuit, which has been very influential in a lot of 20th century thinking about language. As the name indicates, it was concocted by the Swiss linguist Ferdinand de Saussure and included in his Cours de Linguistique Générale, with a very influential work that was posthumously published in 1916. The essence of Saussure's model is that when two people are communicating, a connection is established between two minds. What makes this connection possible is the fact that these two people speak the same language. We rely on language to convert thoughts into messages, and these messages are then sent to the listener. The listener in turn decodes these messages, and in that way he or she can access our thoughts. According to this model, communication is in essence an exchange of information. When we communicate, we exchange information about what goes on inside our heads, about how we interpret our environment, about our mental representations of the world around us, etc., etc., etc. Language, according to this model, is also very much a neutral medium. We put thoughts into words, and the words are a kind of box for our thought. In this view, what matters are the thoughts and not the box in which we pack them. Now, this model of communication, which was initially developed in the early 20th century, has been extremely influential in subsequent theorizing about language. It has been around for quite some time, and it also informs much of our everyday thinking about language. If you would go out in the street and start ask people questions like, "Hey, what does communication look like according to you?" there is a good chance that people will come up with something like this. At the same time, however, it is also a very rudimentary, a very one-dimensional model, which starts from a very narrow understanding of communication. Now, what exactly is missing in this model? How could it be amended? Well, the fundamental problem with this model, of course, is that we also do a whole range of other things with language besides just exchanging messages. And if you think about it for a moment, it soon becomes clear that a lot of what we say is not about informing people. We say hello, we ask questions, we recruit assistants, we make promises, and we commit ourselves to doing things in the future. Occasionally we threaten something, occasionally we threaten someone, etc., etc., etc. All these things that we do with words are very consequential for our social relationships we have with others, but in the end, they have very little to do with exchanging information. The most outspoken example is probably that of a civil servant who pronounces the words, I now declare you legally married. In uttering this formula, the civil servant does not describe a situation, but instead establishes an entirely new reality. From this moment on, the two people standing in front of the servant are officially married before the law, with all the rights and obligations associated with it. It is on the basis of examples like these that philosophers of language like John Austin and John Searle put forward the idea that language is not just a tool for representing the world, but that it also has a performative character. Performativity means that we also use language for carrying out speech acts. And these speech acts establish a new social reality rather than just describing it. This insight has been a first major paradigm shift and it has given rise to a whole new field of research in linguistics and linguistic pragmatics, speech act theory, which examines why and how the speech acts precisely work, under what conditions an utterance may become a successful speech act, under what conditions it fails to do so, etc., etc., etc. But, as I just told you, the authors that I just mentioned were above all philosophers, people who sit down behind their desk and who contemplate the world around them. Hence, most of the ideas they developed about how language works are based on introspection, not on empirical observation of actual speech data. For this reason, their work was in turn criticized by a group of sociologists who would go down in history as conversation analysts. And these conversation analysts did exactly the opposite and started making tape recordings of spontaneous, naturally occurring conversations. In this way, they try to come up with an inventory of the different forms of local order and the different forms of local organization that speakers rely on in order to be understandable to one another. One of the insights these conversation analysts came up with is that when speakers perform an action in and through language, these actions are not isolated speech events, but come in sequences. When you do or say something, you create a framework of expectations, and as the recipient of that action, you are expected to do or say something in return. If someone poses a question, you are expected to respond to that question. If someone greets you, you are expected to return to that greeting. And if you fail to return that greeting, you may be sure it will be noticed. If you are standing in the coffee room, looking out of the window, and a colleague comes stand next to you and complains, "Oh, the weather is just horrible," you are supposed to say something in return and say something about the world, about the weather, and add a kind of complaint of your own. The insight that actions come in sequences is tremendously important because it is through such follow-up actions that you can monitor how your interlocutor interpreted what you just said. Imagine you saying something like, "Somebody just threw a stone at my car," and the other person responds, "Well, it was not me." Then you know that the other person might have interpreted what you said as an accusation. And you know that it might be good to add something like, "Well, don't worry, I know it wasn't you, it was probably just some kids." In this sense, sequence and sequentiality are closely linked to intersubjectivity. It is because actions come in pairs, and because you are always expected to respond to and to acknowledge what the prior speaker just said, that we can make sure that our sense-making proceeds in the same direction. The example, "somebody just vandalized my car," also shows that meaning is never a question, is never only a question of words alone, but always relies on how you connect these words to the previous utterance and to the ongoing activity. Imagine that you call 911 with the message, "somebody just vandalized my car." The moment you make that call, you automatically take for granted that the person at the other end of the line will respond with something like, "and where exactly did this happen?" If the call taker, on the other hand, would respond with, "sorry, it wasn't me," that would just be extremely odd. And of course, it's not impossible for the call taker to respond in such a way. And I'm sure that if you go on YouTube, you can find instances of such calls for help that go horribly wrong. But again, responding in this way would definitely have consequences. And of course, there also exist interactional environments where "somebody just vandalized my car" indeed constitutes an accusation. Oh, and by the way, there is something else that I would like to draw to attention, and that is entirely ignored in Saussure's model. When we communicate, we do not just use our heads, we communicate with our whole bodies. Interaction does not exclusively rely on speech, but is essentially multimodal. Sometimes it is enough that we nod or that we raise our shoulders to show the other that we are engaged in our exchange. We may also use body language to communicate whether or not we are actually available for communication. If you're sitting on a train and you're the whole time staring at your cell phone, you're sending a strong message to your fellow travelers that you're not available for a chat. If, to the contrary, you're actively looking around and trying to establish eye contact, you're letting your fellow travelers know that they can safely approach you. This brings us to something else that is entirely missing in Saussure's model of the communicating heads, and that are the other people who are present in the vicinity. Imagine that you and your friend are sitting on a bus and the two of you are having a conversation. You will probably somehow also take into account that you're not alone in that bus and that there are other people who might be hearing what you're saying. There's a good chance that in one way or another, you'll try to present somehow a favorable image of yourself. In that sense, these co-present but not co-participating fellow travelers do have an impact on the interaction, even though officially they are not part of the dyad. In yet other situations, the dyadic model might simply not be applicable at all. The text that you just read about the Wall of Gachar is a good example of a speech event with a much more complex participation structure than a simple dyad. In Wolof society, just like in Finnish society, it is not socially acceptable to publicly insult other people. Ritual insults like the kahar are only possible because the complex participation structure of the speech event makes it impossible to figure out who exactly is behind the insults. Yes, there is the griot, who writes and recites the poems, but the griot is only a hired gun, and we don't know who sponsored which particular poem. The same ambiguity surrounds the recipient of the insult. Officially, it is the newly married bride, but as we saw, women can also seize the opportunity for formulating political claims and addressing the wider community, including the men who are not officially invited. The Gachar is an instance of an anthropological approach to the study of language that is known as ethnography of communication. This anthropological approach to language starts from the assumption that the use of language is always socio-culturally patterned. In order to understand language use in a particular community, you must always look at a broader picture of the social and cultural practices in which that language use is embedded, including the beliefs and the ideologies that the members of that community hold about their own language use. Of course, you don't have to travel to the other side of the world to come across examples of such complex speech events with intricate participation structures. They can also be found right at your doorstep. I don't know if any of you has ever gone to court, but trial hearings are one such instance of an event with a complex participation structure. A criminal trial typically starts with the prosecutor accusing a defendant. In an ordinary conversation, such an accusation would directly be addressed to the other party, but not so in a trial. Here, the prosecutor directs the accusation at the judge, the one who presides over the hearing. The accused in turn responds to that accusation, but again, he or she will again address his response to the accusation to the judge and not to the party who issued the accusation. Moreover, in most cases, the accused won't be responding in person. Instead, a lawyer will be addressing the court on behalf of the accused. Here, the issue of responsibility for speech again becomes somehow distributed. Just like in the Gachar, the lawyer receives instructions from the accused, but it is the lawyer who chooses the right wording and presents the argument before the judge. The prosecutor, too, does not speak in his own name, but he represents the office. And the office of the prosecutor, in turn, represents the interests of society at large. Again, quite a complicated picture. Of course, this pattern is not set in stone, and under the right circumstances, trial actors might deviate from this pattern. At one point, I did ethnographic research on court cases involving defendants with a minority background, and there, it quite frequently happened that the lawyer, defense lawyer, would indicate to the court that he himself found it difficult to make sense of his client's behavior. The attorney was hence no longer speaking on behalf of the client and is in a way disaffiliating from the one who is supposed to give him instructions. This seems a fairly widespread pattern in cases that involves clients with a minority background, clients who are a cultural other, clients who are allegedly not a member of the same community as the attorney and the other trial actors.
There is one more concept that I would like to briefly discuss with you, and that is mediated action. When two or more people interact with one another, they do so on the basis of objects and tools. These tools may include, first of all, material artifacts. And the drill you see on your screen is one example of this. And probably this is also the first example that comes to mind when you think about tools. However, these material artifacts are not the only tools that actors rely on while they talk. When we talk about tools, we mean all the resources that people draw upon when they enter into interaction. This also includes the signs that they use, and the historically situated ways of speaking and cultural beliefs that they draw upon. What is important is that these tools and objects, conceived in a broad sense and regardless whether they are material or ideational, always have a wider circulation and always have a history. In this sense, the notion of mediation and of mediated action forms a bridge between, on the one hand, the local particulars of an exchange, that is, an interaction between people in a particular time and a particular place, and on the other hand, the broader cultural and socio-political environment in which this exchange is anchored. And that is something that we will talk about in more detail in next class when we discuss context. Okay, there is, of course, a lot more to be said about this, but for today, this is enough. Time to dive into some empirical materials and apply what we have learned to some real-world data.